Hello and welcome to Better Construction with Sean McStay, the podcast where we discuss design and construction techniques, products, and details that lead to a better built environment. All right, and welcome to this week's episode of Better Construction. This week, I am fortunate to have with me Christine Williamson. Christine is the brains behind a very well-known Instagram account called Building Science Fight Club, also obviously a building scientist. Christine, thanks for being on the show.
Thanks for having me, Sean.
Perfect. So for people who maybe aren't familiar with you or maybe only know Building Science Fight Club and that's it, maybe introduce yourself and a little bit about your background.
Sure. I'm Christine Williamson. You got the name. My background is in architecture. And early on in my career, I had the great privilege of working for a really terrific architect in New York City. I was still a student, actually, at the time. I was working for Chris Benedict in New York City on one of the first, it might have been actually the second to be finished, but one of the first multifamily passive houses in the United States. And it was really exciting work. It was really interesting. Chris Benedict is an architect, so I was working in an architectural capacity for her at the time. But what I realized in working on extraordinarily energy efficient designs, which is what Chris exclusively did, was the close connection between architecture and construction if you want to accomplish anything extraordinary from an energy point of view. You can't just be about the design. You also have to understand really, really well what's going on in the field. And Chris was great at that. She gave me my first hard hat. I spent a ton of time in the field and I just fell in love with it. I adored it. And that was really the first That was the first big step in a different, I suppose, maybe a little bit of a non-traditional direction in the building industry, or at least in the architecture industry. Many of my classmates ended up working for commercial and residential firms doing design work, and not having the same opportunities to spend a lot of time in the field and learn more about construction and the construction process. And that was unlike my path, where I started right away in construction. And after I graduated, I worked for a consulting firm working on building enclosure commissioning, doing a bunch of risk mitigation and failure investigations. And I spent a lot of time in the field, learned a lot about construction. So it was a little bit of a different path. I got into teaching more recently, kind of by accident. It was mostly because I took this different path. A lot of my classmates from architecture school would ask me questions about stuff that they were coming across in their daily practices. And a lot of the questions were stuff that they were kind of a little bit afraid to ask other people. Maybe not afraid. It's not like they were literally fearful, but they'd ask a question in a more traditional context, like at their firm. They'd ask a principal or something and they'd get an answer and wouldn't really be satisfied with that answer alone. And so they wouldn't want to press the issue with their principal or with a client or with a contractor, but they knew that they could press the issue with me. So I'd get all of the nitty gritty follow-ups, the ins and outs. And it was fun. I loved answering those questions. I started doing that on Instagram. I'd take photos of actual job sites and I'd start drawing on the photos, marking them up and then posting them on Instagram. And it was started really to in that context, to answer questions or provide information, little tidbits to friends of mine who took a different path in the industry. And it's since grown from there. It turns out a lot of people are finding it hard to get the kind of information that they want to get. And they've found it in this little Instagram community. It's not just me. There's all kinds of professionals that are sharing this kind of visual information in little bite-sized form and interacting with professionals in totally different parts of the world. It's really kind of neat.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's pretty fascinating to see that grow over the last number of years. I mean, I've been in the construction industry in different facets for about 15 years now, and seeing the ability for people to get information on Instagram and YouTube and all these different places that, you know, unless you knew the right person before, you might not have had access to it.
Yeah, exactly. Who do I know to who knows about such and such. And now it's a lot easier to have people in your Rolodex, to use exactly. a way old-fashioned term, in your contact list, I guess.
Exactly. So for you, as architecture and that area of the field always been the plan? Like when you're growing up, was that always the top interest for you, or did it kind of come about in a different way?
No, it wasn't really a part of the plan. I always liked drawing, but I guess I didn't really have a very good sense of what architecture really was, even though people in my family are in the business. But I just didn't seem to really like the idea of drawing for a living. That's sort of how I understood it. And that wasn't interesting to me. I always sort of thought that I'd go into quote unquote business, whatever that meant, business. You go to an office, you do something, and you get paid. What happens in between? I don't know. So I don't know. I guess I figured I wasn't really too specific about it, but I started out after college in a marketing position, which I really didn't like, actually. And I realized after a couple of years that not only did I not like my job, I didn't like anybody else's job. There wasn't anybody else around me whose job I wanted, that I didn't aspire to anything one day. And that's not a very good position to be in professionally, especially when you're young and supposed to be inspired and excited for the next great thing. So I felt pretty lost for a little while and ended up going back to school in Boston. I was taking some continuing education classes at Boston Architectural College in the evenings. Really, it was just to meet people. It wasn't so much, I was like, well, I like it. I like architecture. Let's meet people in a different context than maybe, I don't know, going to a bar. And I started taking these classes and I was like, huh, well, I really like this. There's actually a lot here. There's a lot to this industry. And suddenly meeting people who were practicing the school, Boston Architectural College, it's intended for people who are actually working full-time in the profession. And so suddenly when you meet your classmates are actually working, your professors are practicing architects in different corners of the profession, all kinds of opportunities and possibilities opened up for me, and the profession suddenly became exciting. And I suppose it became exciting because I could see myself in it. And then I went back full time to architecture, but it was a career change. It was tough at the time. I look back now and I kind of laugh. So at 22, I went back to school for architecture. I think I was 22. No. I guess I was 23 or 24. And right around that time, my classmates from college were, you know, some of them were graduating from law school. They were having kids. They just seemed so together and accomplished already. And I thought, again, this is laughable. I just felt like a failure. Like, wow, I'm starting over again at 24. And to be 24 again. But it didn't feel good at the time. You know, I suppose it was fair to feel that way, in that this certainly is a profession where it takes time to develop expertise and competence. And I'd be lying if I said that it was always a joy. I mean, it was hard. It's hard to go to a job and to be paid, you know, day to day for years at a time when you feel like you're asked to do things repeatedly that you don't know how to do. That was demoralizing for a little while. It takes a long time to be good at this stuff. And it's not uncommon for professionals to have really big gaps in their areas of knowledge, of competence. You know, it takes a long time to get good at carpentry, a long time to get good at, you know, any subset of our field. It takes a long time to get good at it. And it can be, that process can be really frustrating for people that need a little bit more reassurance along the way. And I mean, I'm one of those people. I like the positive reinforcement along the way. So it was definitely, I needed to adapt to that, especially in a culture of sort of instant gratification, you know, praise at specific intervals. I was a great student, right? Because I loved the, well, you do this task and you get praised for it. You know, you get evaluated and praised on it right away. And then you move on to the next task. Well, life is a little different. It's just, okay, go do whatever.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I read a book recently by Simon Sinek called The Infinite Game. And he talks about that, in that, you know, we have all these games that we're used to when we're kids that have like a defined set of rules and a defined timeline, and that's it.
Yeah.
And then we go out into life and it's like, there are no official rules, and the only point of the game is to keep playing. Like, there's no end. Well, there is, but there, you know, you're not going towards that. So it's, yeah, it's an interesting way to look at it for sure.
What do you do when the constraints are gone? It's sort of a funny question.
Exactly. So you went to architecture school. A lot of architects, I shouldn't say a lot, but there are many architects who are very focused on the aesthetics. That's kind of their realm. And then the details and such are a little bit less in their purview. You seem to take a very strong interest in both. Did that just come naturally to you? Or was there, like you mentioned, a few places that you worked that they focused on high performance as like kind of their exclusive option? Did that influence you as well, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, to a certain extent, I picked this by default. I learned pretty quickly in architecture school that while I have pretty good taste, I think, I don't have the capacity to produce the designs that I appreciate in other people. So I guess I realized that there's a difference between appreciating music and actually being a musician. So while I really have an appreciation for great architecture, I am not terrific at producing original, beautiful aesthetic designs myself. But what I realized was that this industry is really big and there's room for a lot of different kinds of people in it. And this is, our profession is collaborative, right? It's not enough just to design something beautiful. You're designing something that's going to be built by people, real people, and used. So there's a real gift in this profession being collaborative the way that it is. It's not enough just to focus on the aesthetic part because, you know, you're not just designing sculptures. Your design buildings are things that people actually live in and work in and use. You're creating an interior environment that's useful to people. And there's a lot of different pieces that go into actually creating that. And I get to, in my role in building science and construction, I get to participate in that collaborative process and be part of this wonderful profession. And I get to contribute in the way that I feel like I'm best at and I enjoy the most. So it's a happy accident, I guess, for me that I was able to discover that early through some of my early work experiences. But I guess that's sort of normal too. We gravitate towards the things that we tend to be good at and that we enjoy. So that's how I ended up there. But yeah, absolutely. If it doesn't look good, people aren't going to want to maintain it and pay for it and enjoy it for years to come. That said, I have worked on a lot of really unattractive buildings, sadly. They're not all winners.
Yeah, well, I mean, and sometimes maybe that's a bit to the design team, and other times I think I know here in Vancouver, near where I live, there are many, many restrictions on the designs of the buildings, whether those be heritage or functional related. And so the building doesn't always get to turn out the way that the architect necessarily envisions it either.
Exactly, exactly.
So for you, I mean, I had Stephen Basic on a few weeks ago, and he was talking about how everybody has a job to do on within the construction team, you know, the architects, the engineers, the builders. When it comes to the details and making sure that those things work and that they're buildable, like you were talking about, human beings build these buildings, is that a team thing? Or do you think the architect has to take the reins with that? Who's kind of ultimately in charge of that?
It's a tough question to answer because I think it really, there are a lot of models that actually end up working. I mean, the tough part is when nobody takes charge of it and it ends up sort of accidentally coming together, or when the person that is really more frequently is that the person or people in charge are not being very good leaders and are not coordinating things really well. But ultimately, I think a lot of this comes from the very top, from the owner. And who does the owner decide to put on their team? What kind of professional competence has the owner sought out? What kind of advice are they listening to? And it's difficult to do your job very well if you have clients who are not providing you with the resources to in fact do your job well. I think it really comes from the top. Now, of course, everybody's got a role to play, right? In that so many of our clients, they don't know what they really need. And they trust us as professionals to to provide our professional judgment and make recommendations that will help them toward that end. So there's a lot of give and take there, but I think ultimately it comes from the top.
Interesting. All right. So I guess jumping back to what you started getting into before, and I'm really curious about this with the Instagram side of things and Building Science Fight Club. When you started doing that, did you envision that it would turn into what it has at all? Or was it just simply something you did because you found it interesting?
It's funny. I guess I had kind of, I was of two minds on that at the beginning. In a certain sense, I think I probably used Instagram at the very beginning, a little bit like how a teenage girl uses Instagram, where there's so much crappy content out there. I was like, well, I have a pretty interesting job. I bet if I take photos of me doing my job, people will be interested and they'll follow it, which is so silly. Like, I don't think I'm a boring person, but I don't have a personality that is so compelling that it's going to attract a gazillion followers in and of itself. So at the beginning, I would never have rationalized it to myself that way. I wouldn't have explained it that way. But in looking back, I can think that I probably was doing a little bit of the posting photos of my food type of thing, you know, like presuming that people would be interested. I guess you give people a mic and a stage and suddenly they think that they're interesting. There was a little bit of that at play. I'm not going to lie. I am human. But no, at the beginning, I really, once I sort of shook that off, I really did use it to communicate with other professionals, most of whom I actually knew. I had a direct relationship with them in person. And the idea was to share information, teach the part that I know about and hopefully learn from them, not necessarily from their actual accounts, but learn from their questions. A big part of my job as a consultant is explaining the technical justification for recommendations related to building, right? Like, I think you should build your roof in this way for these reasons. I think this wall assembly is going to be the most appropriate for you in the context of what you want to achieve for these reasons. So a big part of my job already was explaining things. And Instagram early on, I mean, it still does this as well, but early on, it was a place for me to kind of practice that. I got to test drive material that I was explaining daily in my professional capacity. And I was getting feedback, honest feedback, the kind of feedback I wouldn't necessarily get from a professional setting, right? Because people get embarrassed. They don't want to admit that they don't understand something the way I've explained it or what have you. And actually early on, a friend of mine from architecture school, I'd been posting, I think probably for like 6 months. So I'd put a lot of effort into this. And she called me, we were just talking about regular stuff. And I said, well, what do you think about what I've been doing on Instagram? She's a classmate from architecture school. Basically, I passed because of her. She got me through. And she said, well, I like it, but I still only understand about half of what you are saying. And I was like, holy moly, she is like, she's one of the smartest people I know. If I'm not explaining things in a way that she understands, then I'm not explaining them right. The problem isn't her. The problem's me. I'm presuming that my audience knows more than they know. And even when my audience is educated, intelligent professionals who just don't happen to know. And that's, by the way, how I approach the entire Instagram platform of Building Science Fight Club. I'm not presuming that I'm teaching idiots. I'm presuming that I'm teaching smart people who are professionals in this industry who simply don't happen to know this particular thing, whatever the topic of the day is. Anyway, I got much better at teaching after that, but that was really a big turning point.
Interesting. And so you're saying about reactions to it. What are some of the better reactions that you've gotten from people? Have there been any big takeaways people have had, or any someone comes up to you at a conference or something and says that they really enjoy it? Like what kind of positive reactions do you get from your community?
I mean, it's not nothing too crazy. I'm not being asked to sign autographs or anything at the at a local restaurant back when they were open. A friend of mine was saying right before the International Builders Show was saying, "Oh, you're going to be a real celebrity over there. You're gonna have to." And he was kidding. Anyway, when I came back from the show, he asked, "Well, so how was it?" And I said, "It was fine. It was totally normal. It wasn't like I was overwhelmed with being recognized." Building science celebrity, I guess, is sort of like being the tallest building in Kansas type of thing. But it's been really nice to feel like I'm making a positive contribution to our industry and advancing the education that's available and the level of knowledge in our business. Also, a lot of people I'm presenting comments or presenting concepts that a lot of people are actually really familiar with already, but that they have trouble articulating to their clients and their colleagues. So a lot of the teaching that I find is most helpful to people is not in presenting material that they've never seen before, but it's in helping them become more familiar enough with the fundamentals where they can be more convincing in their own practices. And they've got more of a kind of a backup, better technical justification to things that they already know work because they've been doing it in their profession and in their corner of the industry for a long time. And it makes them more confident in their interactions with clients, with architects, with builders, with owners. When challenged on a job site, they can respond a little bit more confidently because they've seen some of these exchanges happen in front of them on Instagram. They've seen the back and forth. It's a whole lot easier to kind of witness a little bit of a sub-debate within the industry or watch how somebody else responds to a technical question when you have no skin in the game. And then that prepares you for when you do another time, you're not caught flat footed by something for the very first time.
Very interesting. Yeah. So that was kind of on the positive side. And I mean, I've do definitely follow the page. And one thing that I'm always very impressed by is how involved you are in the comments, even sometimes with comments that I maybe might not necessarily interact with myself. How do you go about approaching people who are, showing that more negative side of the internet, we'll put it that way?
I privately curse them and then answer very politely and nicely. Occasionally, I will delete comments. Very occasionally, they have to be pretty bad before I delete them. But most of the time, I think there is actually real value in responding even to the comments and questions that are not exactly phrased very diplomatically. And the reason I think there's value in doing that is not so much for the person that the initial person that was disrespectful or rude or whatever, but because these conversations are happening in public and construction is aggressive, almost nothing gets said on Instagram that I haven't heard on a job site that I can imagine somebody saying on a job site. And it's really nice to kind of do a dress rehearsal in your living room wearing your pajamas on a Saturday morning rather than having somebody be abusive on a construction site and not really knowing what the how you might answer that question, even if it's a bad question or a rudely phrased comment or observation or whatever. So I think it ends up being valuable anyway, at least I hope so, because sometimes it's hard to answer some of those questions. But for the most part, I think it's valuable. So I do it anyway. And I also presume, it's online, right? So a lot of stuff gets taken out of context and sometimes people say things with a wink and a smile and you can't see the wink or the smile. So you don't really know. So I do my best to give people the benefit of the doubt and then realize that it's a way for other people to learn. And then the other part of this is that one of the dangers of a site like this becoming more popular is that people feel like they can't actually present dissenting opinions. And that is more comfortable for me, certainly easier when people agree with me. And it's kind of funny now. I think being popular is its own credential now. So I find that people trust my recommendations in ways where in contexts that they never would have trusted earlier in my career. I would say the same thing, but now because I have Instagram followers, they believe me, which is sort of silly. But the danger in not hearing these dissenting opinions is that don't correct yourself when you are wrong. And it's pretty rare, I think, I'm pretty careful about what I say on Instagram and the technical information that I present. So I don't think I've really ever, can't think of anything I've presented that's been wrong, but I have absolutely presented comments and concepts that were incomplete and needed to be clarified in the comments after or by follow-up posts and stuff like that. And that's how we get better at stuff. When you realize like, oh, okay, well, what I said was correct, but hey, there's an exception to that rule. And maybe that exception is worth sharing. It might not happen a whole lot. That's why it's an exception, but it happens. And that's how we get better. It's a learning platform. So it's good to tolerate dissent and hopefully responding as courteously as possible encourages the same in kind. But the dissent is important. Different opinions, because that's our reality. That's our world.
Yeah, I completely agree. I 100% agree. I think that the world overall is very polarized right now, and our industry is not immune from that, obviously. And each of us is going to have a different opinion, but no one opinion is right all the time. And no one person certainly is. So like I said, I find it impressive that you interact with it, sometimes even beyond the point that I might necessarily dive into that rabbit hole. But it's a good thing. It's certainly a good thing to have.
One guy told me, this was actually really kind of funny, and it's been over a year and I still remember this, but one guy commented after one of the video posts I had done, and he had counted the number of times that I'd blinked and accused me of blinking too much. And I was like, obviously it's stupid and abusive and I blocked him. But after I was like, well, I watched the video again. I was like, maybe I do blink too much. Like, come on. And I had an appointment with my eye doctor, my annual appointment to get my contact prescription. And I was like, can I ask you about the blinking thing? She was like, well, you do have very dry eyes, So I've got a prescription for eye drops now, and I'm a conscientious blinker in future videos and presentations because of some jerk of a troll. So I don't answer all of them nicely.
That's definitely understandable. And also that person probably needs to have something more constructive to do with their time.
Blinks. It was a lot of blinks.
Yeah, that's impressive. Okay. One thing that does often get brought up in relation to this and people accusing multiple different Instagram personalities, if you will, in the construction industry comes down to product placement. What is product placement? What's not product placement? When you make a suggestion, is that your personal opinion? Are you being paid to say that? How do you try and handle that with your level of influence on Instagram?
I treat mine as mine is non-commercial. It is completely non-commercial. The account is I don't do any sponsored posts. I don't take money from any manufacturers to feature their product. Now, I believe in furthering an educational mission with this, and it takes a long time for me to put these posts together. So I suppose you could, I'm not a stupid person. It's occurred to me that I could monetize the account by taking sponsorships in that way. But I'm trying not to do that. And the reason is that in our business, continuing education in our industry is largely sponsored by materials manufacturers. And that's fine. That's okay. There's that we owe them a debt of gratitude for furthering, especially the good ones who really invest in advancing our industry in really productive ways. And I'm very grateful for that. And I accept money on behalf of manufacturers to present at live events all the time. It's something I very much enjoy doing, and I'm glad that manufacturers are willing to support the industry in that way. That said, I wanted to offer something different with Building Science Fight Club. I wanted to offer something independent, and I'll keep doing it for free as long as I still have the bandwidth to do it. On the architecture side in particular, our industry is founded on a model of apprenticeship. And this I consider my contribution to that model. It just allows me to reach more people. I'm a sole practitioner, so I don't have any staff. I don't have young people that I'm investing in directly by having them on my payroll. But this is a way for me to participate in that spirit of apprenticeship. And I take that seriously. Now, it also benefits me. It gets me better at my professional practice. It's like I said, I get to practice speaking and teaching, but I don't use it to direct as a direct source of income, because I think that the independence of it is valuable to people. Now, I don't do the sort of cumbersome block, like there will be no mention of any manufacturers. I don't do that either, because that's not how, it's not natural. This started, my Building Science Fight Club, it started as a discussion between people who know each other. And that's professional to professional. That's how you interact. You say, this is the material I used last time, and this is what I liked about it, to your friend. Have you had any issues with it? What do I need to know? If, you know, here's what you need to know if you're thinking of using it for the first time. We have opinions. It's completely natural. And as long as we can justify those opinions and share them in a way that's clear about where our biases come from, then I think that people are really willing to work with that. And that said, I learn from all kinds of people who do go the sponsorship route, and that's great. I'm going to try to hold off as long as I can. We'll see. I think that people are also willing to pay directly for their own education, and they certainly have in my practice offline. People will pay me to teach. Architects will pay me to come to their offices for a day and give them classes. And so people will make direct investments on their own. We'll see how many of them do. It can continue to do that, so I can keep doing Building Science Fight Club. But for now, it's non-commercial.
That's really interesting. It's a good way to take it. I mean, I think that I don't personally find anything inherently wrong with sponsored partnerships and stuff like that, as long as you're upfront about it. But I do find about your social media in particular that's really interesting, because there is a wide variety of different products that you feature, and it seems like you just kind of pick whatever you think is the best fit for that detail.
Yeah, and I also, these photos that I'm using are coming from my actual professional practice, or what I'm seeing around me in I live in Dallas, or what I'm seeing when I travel to other places in a professional capacity. So if a manufacturer has a new product and sort of laments that I don't show their stuff as much, well, it's because I'm not seeing it. I'm not working with it. It doesn't mean it's not good. It just, I'm one person. I'm just, you know, teaching one thing at a time, and I teach what I'm already working on. So there's definitely some bias in selection bias there, but I'm just one person.
Well, that makes a lot of sense though. So when you're not traveling around and speaking about building science and doing Building Science Fight Club, what other kind of hobbies keep you busy?
Well, these days I'm watching a lot of Netflix.
Yeah, I think that's pretty much everyone at this point.
a lot of Netflix, a lot of couch time. No, I think one of my favorite things to do is walk. Actually, I really enjoy walking. It's good. It's good exercise, and it's a great way to learn and explore a new city. And it's just so great. Having the iPhone now has been such a great professional tool. I'll walk even in my own city, different routes, and take photos of construction sites and different methods and means of putting our buildings together. And sometimes those show up on Building Science Fight Club, but I'm a big walker, walking and Netflixing.
Yeah, I think all of us that have been in the industry for a little while pretty much have that disease where even if we're in a city, we're not there for work, we see the construction fencing or something, then it's like, oh, what's going on down that way?
Honey, hold on, pull over. I just have to take a picture.
Yeah. My wife's actually getting pretty good at spotting our competitors, and then she writes down the address and says, there was a job with such and such competitor at this address. You should check it out.
My husband is getting to be a pretty good building scientist too. He'll say, hit the joke in the family is because I focus on drainage so much. So his joke is when I talk about something done wrong, he says, drainage mat, drainage mat, drainage mat.
Perfect. So when I get towards the end of these podcasts, I typically ask two questions. And so the first question is, if there was one misconception about better construction that you could just eliminate from people's minds, what would it be?
Oh my gosh. Okay. A single one. I think the number one failure that I see, what's at the root of it, because I see so many iterations of the same, or versions, variations of the same failure. And the underlying presumption is a confusion about finished functions and control functions. So what in my building is serving a is serving in a control capacity, and what is serving as an aesthetic finish? And this is very confusing because sometimes these roles get mixed up. The sort of classic example is when a parapet meets a wall and you terminate the roofing that goes up the parapet to the face of the brick cladding and not to the water control layer that's behind the brick cladding. So you're confusing the finish function of the brick. You've got a finish material, it's an aesthetic finish, with the control function, the water control membrane. So you can you confuse your finish functions and your control functions. So we'll seal a window to cladding, not to the water and air control layer behind it. And I see like a zillion versions of the same mistake.
Very interesting. Yeah, I definitely second that. If we could get rid of that, we would solve a lot of the problems.
We sure would.
For sure. All right. And then the second question is just more of a personal interest question. I collect a lot of books, and I always ask people if you could recommend one book, personal or professional, to somebody, which one would it be?
Oh, you know what? I am reading a really fascinating book for that people in this industry in particular might enjoy. It's called Anti-Fragile. Nicholas Taleb, I believe, is the writer. And it's a fantastic book. It's not about our industry at all, but I love the concept as applied to our industry. And the concept of anti-fragility is this, that there are some systems that actually improve when they face uncertainty and disruption. And as opposed to other systems that do not. So for example, if you think of lighting a match, wind will extinguish that flame, but wind will also feed a forest fire or a house fire. So you've got this one system deals with a stressor and improves, in a bad sense for us, but improves. And in another sense, it extinguishes it. And that's really, really interesting. And it's a different concept than resilience. Resilience or robustness is something that takes a licking and keeps on ticking. You know, it is neutral in, it can resist a stress or a challenge, but something that's anti-fragile actually gets stronger as a result. And it's a fascinating book. I suspect that the author is maybe a little bit crazy, but definitely crazy genius. And he's presenting very, very original thinking. And it's been a delight to read and to think about how in our industry, like a single instance of failure is bad in that case for that client, for that building, whatever it is. But if we can set our industry up right, it could be good for our industry in that we make industry-wide improvements in the form of code changes or what have you to make our industry respond better to disruption and stressors. Anyway, it's kind of neat. It's got a lot of really cool ideas in it that are floating around my head right now. Terrific, terrific book for anybody. I want lots of people to read it, and they can talk to you and me about those ideas, because I'd love to hear how other people think that they can apply to that concept to the building industry, the idea of making things less fragile.
Oh, that sounds fascinating. I'm definitely going to check that out for sure. Well, Christine, thank you so much for being on the show. For everyone listening, I'm going to put links to Christine's web, social media and website and such in the description, and I'll link to it when I post, of course. So once again, Christine, thanks for being here.
Well, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.